Welcome back to Cartels, Conspiracies, and Camarena. I'm Jack Llewellyn, and thank you for joining me again this week. Before we get into the topic of the day, a little bit of news from last week. Ruben Oseguera Gonzalez, El Menchito, the son of CJNG leader El Mencho, rejected the latest and allegedly last plea offer presented to him by the prosecution. And it appears that then he will be going to trial this fall. The plea agreement included a recommendation that he be sentenced to 40 years in prison in exchange for pleading guilty to two charges against him. The government presented that plea deal and made their latest offer on Monday, May 13th in federal court. It was rejected, and there now will be hearings starting in September and a proposed trial date of October 24th. Apparently, the government had met with El Menchito and his attorneys on several occasions, including at least twice in April, in an effort to convince him to take the plea agreement. If you remember, late last fall, there were indications that El Menchito was about ready to plead guilty, and then allegations that he was visited by family members or intermediaries with his family and changed his mind. In any event, the latest, and as I said, apparently or allegedly the last offer from the prosecution was rejected, and we should expect a trial of El Menchito sometime this fall. Okay. The topic of the day, if you subscribe to my newsletter, you may have seen an indication of this article in last week's newsletter. I ran across an article, an article doesn't do it justice. It's a journal article. It is a scholarly work that came and was published in the Journal of Illicit Economies and Development. Journal of Illicit Economies and Development. And it talks about Mexican money laundering in the United States. And after citing it in the newsletter, I took a deeper look at it this week and thought that it might be something interesting for our discussion here. So I'm going to start with an abstract, or their abstract, and tell you what it says. But before I do that, I want to note this is a very good article in the sense that it's heavily cited, it's well developed, it's also a little bit longer than we would normally go through. So I'm not going through all of the article, but we will try to hit the high points. The abstract says, this article explains some of the mechanisms through which corruption by high-level Mexican politicians and other organized crime members is facilitated in the United States through money laundering operations. The analysis is based on information contained in court records related to key money laundering cases, as well as news articles and reports from law enforcement agencies. These materials highlight the interrelationship among U.S. drug use, cartel activities in Mexico, human rights abuses, Mexican political corruption, and money laundering in the United States. This work demonstrates the pervasive use of legitimate businesses and fronts in the United States as a disguise for criminal activity. Finally, it provides recommendations for a reformation of policies and penalties directed towards U.S. institutions and persons that facilitate money laundering. Now, one of the things that the authors do, and I should mention the authors. So the authors are Guadalupe Correa Cabrera, Charles Lewis, and William Jaworski. Okay. And you can look up their information. And again, you can always go back to the newsletter from last week for a link to the article. One of the things that the authors do is takes us back in time a little bit and talks about the fact that organized crime, cartels, corrupt politicians have been routinely laundering hundreds of millions of dollars in the United States. The article says these criminal acts include those by governors of several Mexican states, as shown by the U.S. federal court actions in Texas and New York over the last 25 years, Mexican investigations and prosecutions, and public media accounts. But the illegality is not limited to regional actors. Recent court actions have reached the upper levels of the Mexican national security apparatus, as shown by the conviction of Genaro García Luna, the Secretary of Public Security, from 2006 to 2012 in U.S. District Court in Brooklyn in 2023. And we've talked about that case several times. The article continues, though, to say, unfortunately, the García Luna scandal was not the first to reach the upper echelons of Mexican political power. The first Mexican drug czar, General Jesús Gutiérrez Rebollo, was arrested in Mexico in February 1997 for accepting cartel bribes and was later convicted in Mexico. The bribe notebook seized in Mexico with the arrest of Gulf cartel boss Juan García Abrego in 1996 indicated multiple bribes at the federal level of law enforcement in Mexico of up to $1 million that included the head of the Federal Judicial Police, the chief of operations, and the federal police commander in Matamoros, García Abrego's home turf. Testimony from a cartel witness in the 2018-2019 New York federal trial of El Chapo included sworn statements from the witness stand that the immediate past president of Mexico, Enrique Peña Nieto, requested a Sinaloa cartel bribe in the range of $250 million but settled on a bribe of $100 million. Peña Nieto denies the accusation. The New York Times has published additional information about other bribery allegations involving Peña Nieto. Beginning in 1994, various relatives of Mexican President Carlos Salinas de Gortari, who was president in 1988-1994, were implicated in large-scale financial scandals involving tens of millions of dollars in overseas accounts and transfers. The Swiss government froze various accounts. One of Salinas's brothers was imprisoned for the 1994 murder of Guerrero, ex-governor and sitting pre-party head Jose Francisco Ruiz Maciel, but was later released. The decedent was the brother-in-law of the then-president Salinas. Another brother was found dead in a vehicle with a plastic bag taped around his head. After President Salinas left office, he voluntarily exiled himself to Ireland for a number of years. President Andrés Manuel López Obrador has augmented Mexico's federal intelligence capabilities and appears to be prioritizing, at least to some degree, the effort against money laundering. However, low levels of trust and synergistic efforts or effects of legality have contributed to the persistence of corruption. At the same time, the drugs trade itself has influenced, to some extent, the shape of Mexican institutions. Furthermore, arbitrary powers exercised by functionaries at all levels of government, which manifest themselves in the phenomena of extortion and bribery, remain problematic. While some observers argue that democracy reduces perceptions of corruption, Mexico's judicial system lags behind in reforms towards independence. They said one particular scholarly article sums up a widespread sentiment. That is, corruption is the system in Mexico. And we've talked about that dozens of times on these podcasts. And almost any time I talked to people from Mexico, people who have worked in Mexico extensively, that's something that comes up over and over and over. Corruption is the system. Corruption is a part and parcel of the fabric of society and, as this says, the system in Mexico. The article then goes on to talk about money laundering laws in the United States. And we won't go into a great deal of detail on this, but here's the basics. At the federal level, Title 18 of the U.S. Code, Sections 1956 and 1957 are the primary statutes involved. They have enabling forfeiture provisions that go along with them, so that in addition to a criminal penalty, there can be forfeitures associated with them. The criminal penalties are significant under both sections. Under 1956, it can be up to 20 years for each offense. It's up to 10 years under the other section. There is no parole in the federal system. So if a prisoner is sentenced in the federal prison system, that person can assume to serve 85% or so, even with good behavior. So at its core, Section 1956, which is the primary statute of the two sections, it's the primary one used, it prohibits engaging in certain financial transactions with criminal proceeds from an enumerated list of crimes that the article says is both expansive and focused. So you, under Section 1956, it is illegal to engage in certain financial transactions in two different circumstances. One is knowing that the transaction is designed in whole or in part to conceal or disguise the nature, location, source, ownership, or control of such proceeds. Or number two, with the intent to promote a specified illegal activity. Notably, the two federal statutes, 1956 and 1957 under Title 18, apply to proceeds generated by illegal activity occurring in other countries, provided there is a nexus of these funds, such as their transfer to the United States. So jurisdiction is established when those funds are transferred or otherwise brought into the United States. And that becomes the key. I will note there are a couple of exceptions where certain illegal activity may not fall under 1956 or 1957, but we won't worry about them too much now. The article then goes into it's an interesting case study, and it involves the Los Zetas and the horse racing business. And I'm just going to read a little bit from the article because this is just, it's super interesting. So this case involved the laundering of currency from the sale of illicit narcotics by purchasing, breeding, training, and racing horses. Testimonies from the trial of various conspirators in this criminal organization revealed that during a 30-month period, key members of Los Zetas spent nearly $16 million in Texas, Oklahoma, New Mexico, and California on horse operations. Los Zetas' drug money was laundered by acquiring land, purchasing, breeding, caring for, training, and racing quarter horses using fronts. Illegal drug proceeds from sales in the United States were, at times, delivered in cash to operatives in the United States to support the horse operations, rather than delivering all the profits back to Mexico. Within the horse operation, the same horse would be sold and resold in a continual cycle at different legitimate horse auctions in the United States using drug money for purchases. This was performed in order to give the false appearance that the horse auction proceeds were legitimate. This is one of the interesting parts about this affair. The laundering of proceeds included semen laundering. And I dare say that this may be the first time anybody's heard the phrase semen laundering. But this is a situation where semen from one Zeta-controlled or owned horse was used to impregnate another Zeta horse. The resulting stud fees that were transferred between and among the conspirators could then be claimed as clean. The Zetas also intermingled the horse laundering business with their kidnapping and extortion business. One victim of kidnapping, after suffering several beatings, torture, and a ransom demand of $4.5 million, was released and thereafter instructed to fly to Oklahoma City for a horse auction, where he paid $310,000 for a horse worth only $15,000, thus laundering $295,000. This same victim turned his home over to the Zetas, paid attorney's fees for a Zeta operative, and was told to send hundreds of thousands of dollars in checks to the horse operation. The reach of the Zetas extended even to the premier national quarter horse race in the United States, the 2010 All-America Futurity Race, equivalent to the Kentucky Derby. Approximately $110,000 in bribes were paid to the gate operators, those who opened the starting gate for each horse, to delay the openings slightly to give the Zeta horse an advantage, and the Zeta horse won, quote, by a nose. The person who arranged for the delayed gate openings was paid in kilos of cocaine for his services. The money laundering from the horse operation was, of course, just a small slice of a much longer and larger quantity of Zeta money flowing through the U.S. financial system. Los Zetas was one of several cartels, cited for the movement of illegal money through HSBC. The amount of drug money involved was officially found to be $880 million. Total penalties, forfeitures, and structural costs assessed were in the range of $1.9 billion. The article notes that by dissecting a well-known Zeta case, we are not suggesting that this is the current industry-wide standard for money laundering. Cartel evolution is somewhat to division or reformation on a cellular level. So too, money laundering methods evolve. Drug musclemen ferrying duffel bags stuffed with rubber-banded U.S. currency into bank lobbies have been replaced with corporate types representing shell corporations. Traffickers will continue to seek better methods to launder money as well as to identify perceived weaknesses in the U.S. financial system. I'll note that there's two other case studies that were presented that are very interesting. But again, I think the point is the methods, the extent to which cartels, drug traffickers, money launderers are nimble, creative, resourceful, and find new and different ways to move their money in ways that are harder and harder for government and law enforcement agencies to monitor. The The article also notes that in addition to these investigations, the investigations really are just emblematic of a deeper problem and a deeper dynamic. And they go on to say various other investigations have been carried out in Mexico and in the United States that focused on Mexican corruption, theft, bribery, and money therefrom laundered in the United States. And here's a partial list of those investigations. Mario Villanueva Madrid, former pre-governor of Quintana Roo, was convicted of money laundering in federal court in New York by a plea of guilty in 2012. Andres Granier Melo, former pre-governor of Tabasco, was arrested for embezzlement and other charges in Mexico. Cesar Duarte, former pre-governor of Chihuahua, was extradited from the United States to Mexico in 2022 to face public corruption charges. Roberto Borges Anguelo, former pre-governor of Quintana Roo, was arrested in 2017 on Mexican money laundering charges at the airport in Panama while boarding a flight to Paris. Roberto Sandoval Castaneda, pre-governor of Nayarit, was charged with corruption and accused of receiving bribes from cartels in exchange for protection. His attorney general was also arrested for allegedly participating in an international narcotics distribution conspiracy. Jaime Rodriguez Calderon, former governor of Nuevo León and presidential candidate, was arrested in Mexico in 2022 for election fraud. Importantly, the article says, neither our research nor experience show that corrupt Mexican officials have involved themselves in the laundering of cartel funds while in cartel possession, or that such officials look to the cartels to launder the bribes once ownership has passed to those in governmental power. Essentially, the bribes are fee for service, the fee being the bribes and the service being a degree of the official's non-interference and sometimes assistance with cartel operations. Our focus has been on elected officials on the Mexican state level, the governors, who climbed into political power in the states where they were then elected, the areas of cartel operations and hence more active bribery are on the state level, especially those Mexican states that serve as entry and exit platforms in and out of the territory of Mexico. All right. Then the article ends with a series of proposals, propositions, ideas, thoughts on how the money laundering can be stemmed, the tide of money laundering can be slowed down. And they start with saying we need an informed citizenry. They suggest that it's time for a round of congressional hearings in the United States. The purpose would be to fully inform the citizenry of the United States of the overall size, scope, and consequences of transnational organized crime and its financial arrangements. Specific details from past investigations should be made available in a form that does not endanger the sources of the information. We recommend these hearings because, we argue, an informed citizenry is more likely to support solutions than an uninformed and hence disconnected citizenry. Second, we should enact enabling civil legislation at the federal and state levels that would allow U.S. citizens and non-citizen residents of the United States to sue financial institutions and certain bank employees that have received, possessed, or transferred funds of a criminal organization where the person bringing the suit has either one, suffered harm as a result of the acts of the criminal organization or its associates, or two, is the estate of a deceased person who has died as the result of acts of the criminal organization or its associated or its associates, including the use of its products. The thought also goes that there should be rebuttable presumptions as part of the enabling legislation, which would allow the jury to draw inferences about corrupted proceeds and association with a criminal organization when certain predicates are shown. Monetary recoveries under such new statutes would be cumulative to any fines, penalties, seizures, forfeitures, or costs levied on the financial institution by a federal or state governmental or regulatory entity. Third, we must assess whether current criminal penalties for money laundering are sufficient to deter criminal conduct. You know, on that one in particular, you know, there's always the question of at what degree or what level of penalty would provide a deterrence for whatever the particular crime is. In the case of money laundering, drug trafficking, other work for the cartels, you know, the money is so big. Or as we talked about earlier, the example earlier, if you are involved because it's a threat to your life or the life or security of family members, friends, etc., is there a penalty that would be strong enough up to and possibly even including death penalties that would really act as a deterrent, right? If you have no economic prospects other than working with the cartels, does it matter what the penalty is? Now, perhaps the better example is if it's high enough on people in the United States, which then goes back to that enabling legislation that they discussed or proposed as proposal number two. Their fourth proposal is that federal banking regulations should provide regulatory authority to readily ban a person from employment in a bank where it is shown that that person was the officer of responsibility for an account used to launder money for a criminal organization, even if the officer himself was not convicted of a related crime. Are bankers going to be more diligent, more aware, more conscientious if they think they could be blacklisted from the industry if they allow money laundering to occur in their bank? Proposal number five, where a foreign bank or branch has played an ongoing or significant role in receiving, processing, or transmitting substantial sums to U.S. financial institution, shown to be proceeds of organized crime or political corruption, the law should terminate that bank's access to the U.S. financial system. One of the issues with that, of course, is the tremendous interconnection between financial institutions in the United States and those in Mexico as it relates to the continually increasing trade and economic viability between both countries. So the degree to which you, I suppose the best way of saying it is, would you be causing more problems by terminating a Mexican bank's ability to do business with U.S. banks because of the harm to the economy than you would be helping on, you know, prohibiting or acting in a way to stem the tide of money laundering? And then the last question/proposal for this article was, have we devoted enough resources to fighting the laundering of corrupt foreign money in the United States? You know, the idea is, if you implement some of the legislation that they had talked about, you're going to have an increased workload on financial investigators, prosecutors, and others. And where will those resources come from? The conclusion for the article and the authors is, we do not believe that our proposals will eliminate all money laundering. In fact, we recognize that the reforms we support will only do so much. It is a complex transnational situation that confronts us. We are operating in an area of legal pluralism, and there are political and foreign policy considerations too numerous to fully address here. Yet we hope that this short paper helps initiate discussion on the reforms we have proposed. As long as the proposed solution doesn't require breaching the laws of physics, presumably any problem can be solved, and we hope our paper contributes to this project. So that's the article, and I thought, since we talked so much about different issues relating to money laundering in the past, the idea of you know, just so much cash. Remember last week we talked about cash, bundled cash being stopped at the borders of several states last year, and we're talking millions of dollars. I have information from others that the amount of cash going back and forth across the border is, to call it staggering would be an understatement. So I thought this might be an interesting analysis and something that that you might enjoy. Again, it comes from the Journal of Illicit Economies and Development. It's in the newsletter from last week. Take a look at it if you want some more information. And that, my friends, is the episode for today. I hope you enjoyed this. This is podcast episode number 96. And I've got a couple of interesting things planned when we hit the big 100, which is going to be a couple of news updates. And we're going to take the occasion of the 100th to go back to where we started and talk a little bit about the Camarena case and, some new insights, or at least different ways of looking at things. So I'm really looking forward to that. We'll have some other interesting things in the next couple of weeks. And with that, I will let you go for today. Have a great week, and we will talk to you next week on Cartels, Conspiracies, and Camarena. Take care, everyone.